Cultivo Raíces presenta su programa
Espejos de Aztlán.
Información,
arte,
cultura.
Bienvenidos.
Today on Espejos de Aztlán we have a special guest, Dr. Thomas Sáenz, MALDEF president. MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, is a national organization founded in the 1960s to defend Latino legal and civil rights. Dr. Thomas Sáenz speaks with us about some priorities in the defense of Latinos' civil rights, especially regarding the right to vote. Mr. Sáenz also talks about his deep concerns about other topics affecting New Mexicans, such as wage theft by New Mexico's Taxation and Revenue Department, the right to equal access to public education, and the federal immigration programs DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and DAPA, Deferred Action for Parental Accountability. For Espejos today, Cristina Bachín. Así verás. We are today in Espejos de Aztlán with Thomas Sáenz, President and General Counsel of MALDEF, the Latino legal voice for civil rights in America. Thank you so much for joining us today, Thomas.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And we are glad that you are visiting New Mexico, and I guess there are many topics to talk about. We would like to talk with you about education as a right, but particularly how is the situation of DAPA and DACA and DREAMers, as we are in a university with students in those programs. And then we want also to talk about wage theft also. As we are with you here, we want to take also the opportunity to talk about Latino voting rights. How about that agenda?
Sounds great.
Let's begin to talk about how is the situation, particularly if there are students listening there, of the DAPA and DACA programs.
So as you know, President Obama announced at the end of 2014 an expansion of the pre-existing DACA initiative, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And through that program, hundreds of thousands of students have received the right to be free of the fear of deportation and have obtained work authorization. But this would have expanded that initiative to make more people eligible. And at the same time, he announced a new initiative, DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, which would relieve millions of parents of the same fear, daily fear of being removed from the country, which of course would have positive repercussions for their children, who often are forced to go to school with that lingering fear in their heads that they might come home and one or both of their parents would be in detention or already in the process of being removed from the country. So there were important initiatives that have been held up by a court case filed by the state of Texas, joined by 25 other states or state officials. And they were able to obtain an injunction preventing the implementation of those two initiatives. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court. That injunction was heard by the court, but regrettably, there are only 8 justices on the court. And ultimately, at the end of June 23rd, the end of their term, they released a one-line order indicating that they were deadlocked 4 justices to 4. And the effect of that deadlock is to leave in place that injunction without any opinion from the Supreme Court whatsoever. So since that happened, it has not gotten the attention in the media that it probably warrants. These initiatives are so important, not just to those who would receive deferred action, but to the communities that they live in and ultimately to the economic development of states, including New Mexico, around the country where there are thousands of folks who are eligible to potentially receive this relief. And so the good news in that regard is that there is still pending a petition or request for the Supreme Court to rehear the case. And they haven't rejected that, and that's very important because they could decide, the 8 justices, to rehear the case, and they would do so when a 9th justice is on the court. That could be, of course, as soon as the end of this year or the 2017, if they grant the petition for rehearing. And at MALDEF, where we represent the only interveners in the lawsuit, 3 South Texas mothers who would be eligible for DAPA once it's implemented, we are very much hoping that the Supreme Court will rehear and will, with 9 justices, decide to overturn the preliminary injunction because it's unwarranted. Really, what the president did is well supported by not just the law as written, but by the actions of many of his predecessors, including the president who had a program of similar scope in relation to the population, who was, of all people, President Ronald Reagan, who provided discretionary relief, or intended to provide discretionary relief, to lots and lots of undocumented immigrants during his tenure. So it is, of course, very troubling that this president has had his authority challenged in court, where those others, including President Reagan, did not have their authority challenged. But it's more important that we get relief to folks who are raising families, contributing to our society and our economy, and should not have to live in daily fear, nor should their children live in daily fear that they might be removed. So we are hopeful that that petition for rehearing will lead to some change in what's going on today.
So there is still hope. Is there any kind of advice you could tell them regarding this topic?
Well, I think that the community has been very, very supportive of the president, and they were even there at the Supreme Court argument in April. Really hundreds and hundreds of people, unprecedented, I think, in the court's history, outside of the court on the day that it was argued. And I think keeping up that support, making it known, and frankly, looking at the 26 plaintiff states and asking why they participate in this lawsuit. None of these states are required to challenge the president's authority. They made a decision to challenge the president's authority, and that decision is one that they ought to be required to support by those in their state. But I think the initiatives are just too important to the community across the board. And again, the community beyond those who would ultimately receive deferred action, that something has to happen in regard to this set of issues.
Hopefully it will happen, and particularly with the activism of our Latino community, that it's becoming more and more involved in politics and hopefully more heading to the elections time. We were talking about the well-being of Latino community. And in New Mexico, we are having this topic that we can call wage theft of immigrants. To put a topic or a title to this behavior of the Taxation and Revenue Department that affects our Latino family. What's going on with the Taxation and Revenue Department and our secretary?
Demesia Padilla.
Demesia Padilla.
Well, the lawsuit that we, together with working with folks in New Mexico, challenged, that we filed to challenge what that department was doing, is fortunately and positively in the process of being resolved. What they were doing is basically keeping the tax refunds that these folks had earned through their wages.
That's why it's called wage theft.
Exactly.
It's
a portion
a way
of their wages.
Of, uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a portion of their wages that they're entitled to receive back through tax refund that they were not receiving. And it targeted specifically those who filed their tax returns using an ITIN, a federal taxpayer identification number, rather than a Social Security number. So it's quite clear that the policy and practice was designed to target the immigrant community, since they would be the ones, by and large, who would use an ITIN rather than a Social Security number. And it was keeping their tax refunds while returning everyone else's tax refund.
It's quite a hypocrisy, because I was just reading the main goal when Governor Martinez was appointing Demesia Padilla, and they were saying that she would take care of our families. It's a way of taking care of our families by stealing their wage.
No, I think that it's quite clear that she was focused on only certain families and not others. This is a form of discrimination, there's no question. And it's discrimination against immigrants and failing to recognize that their families, as you've indicated, are often mixed families. They include United States citizen children, and they are growing up here and going to be expected, with their family support, to contribute to New Mexico's economy and its further development as a state. Only they're being hamstrung by policies that discriminate against them, like holding back tax refunds. But again, on a positive note, that's being resolved and will result, we believe, in.
How many families or people Is there an estimate that were affected by this?
We were talking about thousands of families that were affected over more than 1 year. So it is important that the policy is going to end and that there'll be some relief for those who had their wages held back from them. And hopefully that will be a positive recognition of the ongoing significant contribution of immigrant families to New Mexico.
We are with Thomas Saenz, President and General Counsel of MALDEF, the Latino Legal Voice for Civil Rights in America. And by the way, if you are just hearing about this association, New Mexicans were big contributors to this association. Just we can remember one of their founders, who was Dan Sosa Jr.
The former Supreme Court Justice here in New Mexico was one of our founders. 48 years ago, we opened our doors in San Antonio, Texas, and that was after an effort led by activists and lawyers from throughout the Southwest, from Texas to California, and certainly New Mexicans were represented by Justice Sosa, who was obviously not a justice then, but a lawyer who was working to improve things for the community. Since we opened our doors, we have done lots of work working with New Mexican organizations, working with New Mexican residents on some of the critical issues. And that's in part because, of course, New Mexico is unique in the country. This is the state with the highest proportion of Latinos in its population. And in many ways, then, it is a predictor of where the rest of the country will ultimately end up, because we know that the Latino community is growing and will be expected to play a bigger and bigger role. We have been the largest minority group in the country for a decade. And today, 1 in 4 public school students nationwide is Latino. And that's a measure of where we will be in the workforce and leadership of the future, and why it's so important to ensure equal educational opportunity for all Latino students.
Which in New Mexico still is struggling. The equal access to education is also part of the fights, and I know there are lots of community organizations working on this, particularly about discrimination in education. Are there any news about this lawsuit that was Luis Martinez versus State of New Mexico?
Well, it's a case that's ongoing, and it's a critically important case. Martinez versus New Mexico is a case challenging how public schools are funded and monitored in the state of New Mexico, and whether that is sufficient to guarantee an adequate and equitable education. The case focuses on Latino students, English learners, Native American students, and special education students. And we contend that the state is not doing enough to ensure that those students and others are receiving the equal educational opportunity to which they are entitled under the New Mexico Constitution. And that last issue is the critical development so far in the Martinez case. In rejecting a motion to dismiss, the trial court concluded that, in fact, New Mexico's state constitution does guarantee an equal right to education. And that's important because folks may not know it, but our federal constitution, since a decision made by the Supreme Court in the 1970s, has not recognized education as a fundamental right. In the 1970s, the U.S. Supreme Court basically said our constitution does not view education as a fundamental right. Therefore, unless you can demonstrate intentional discrimination on the basis of race, for example, you cannot be in federal court to challenge the equity of public schooling. So you have to go state by state, and this Martinez case is critical for the state of New Mexico.
How this discrimination takes shape as actions that can evidence this discrimination in the state of New Mexico, as you clarified?
It takes place in number one, not ensuring that the resources are sufficient to address the needs of children in school, recognizing, for example, that English learners will have to have more resources to in their education in order to reach the level that English fluent students are at. So it's first of all making sure the resources are there that are not just equal but adequate for the specific needs of each group of students. And second, it's in making sure that those resources, if they are provided, that's still an if, but if and when they are provided, it's making sure that they're being expended wisely to ensure that, students are actually achieving and succeeding. And that's the monitoring. The state has an obligation not just to fund mm-hmm. education adequately and equitably, but then to monitor and make sure that the dollars are being spent in each school district and school in a way that will actually address the achievement of all students, and specifically to close that achievement gap that we have seen for so many years and continue to see faced by Latino students, for example.
We are with Thomas Sanz, President General Counsel of MALDEF, the Latino Legal Voice for Civil Rights in America, based in California, but touching everywhere.
Touching everywhere. We do that through a network of regional offices. So we still have a regional office, a very strong one, that actually serves New Mexico in San Antonio, Texas, where we were founded. We have a regional office in Washington, D.C., where we do lots of important policy work and litigation. And we have a regional office in Chicago to address the needs of Latinos in that region as well. We're a small organization, but we try to have an impact nationwide, and I think we have had an impact nationwide.
And I want to take the opportunity that you are here and we are talking about Latinos' rights, and there is one sensitive in this delicate time, Latino voting rights. Can we say that Latino voting rights are in risk these days for this election?
I think that there are reasons to be concerned. There are folks who have every interest in their mind in deterring or preventing Latino participation because they are concerned that Latinos will not vote in favor of those they support. And across the country, they have taken steps to try to deter participation. That includes voter identification measures. I know that that's being debated even here in New Mexico. But also restrictions on voter registration, making it more difficult for people to register or for those who are interested in registering them to go about doing their work, and measures that are designed to confuse and to render it more difficult to actually vote on Election Day or before Election Day. So we've seen restrictions on the right of early voting, preventing people from voting prior to Election Day or limiting their opportunity to do so. And all of these measures are intended to target specific voters, and Latinos are among them. So we know that that's going on. And fortunately, in this presidential election year, we don't have the same level nationally of Department of Justice oversight of what's going on with respect to voting rights because of a decision that the U.S. Supreme Court made 3 years ago called Shelby County versus Holder, in which the court basically said the process of preclearance, which had been in existence since the Voting Rights Act in 1965 first enacted, that required certain jurisdictions, states, parts of states, with a history of low voter participation and a history of taking steps to try to deter and prevent participation, would have to pre-clear any electoral change with the Department of Justice, which would evaluate the submitted changes for whether they intentionally discriminated against minority voters or whether they had the effect of going backward with respect to minority voting rights. So the Supreme Court basically disabled that whole preclearance process. So we don't have that this go around. We won't see changes vetted in advance of the election. And I think it's important to note that that has an effect on every state in the union, not just the ones that were covered by preclearance, which included neighboring Arizona, the entire state, included neighboring Texas, the entire state. But it really has an effect nationwide because that process meant that we would know nationwide what are the kinds of changes that are likely to deter or have the effect of deterring participation by minority voters. And it ranged from things like moving precincts, consolidating precincts, to voter ID provisions, to changes in the structure of election. I'll give you one example. We're right now in litigation in Texas with a city that because Latinos were becoming a majority of the voters and therefore would have been able to elect a majority of the city council, changed from 8 single-member districts, meaning that the Latino community could be a majority in 4 and maybe 5 of those 8 districts. They switched from 8 districts to 6 districts and 2 at-large seats. And the reason that they did that is that they could put off the ability of Latinos to take a majority on the city council because they know, regrettably, levels of participation in the Latino community among eligible voters are lower than among white eligible voters. So they knew that the at-large seats, 2 of them, would end up being selected by white voters. And by having those 2 votes on the council, they could prevent Latinos from taking majority control. And the city of Pasadena, Texas, did that because of that Shelby County decision that permitted them to make the change without having to have it reviewed by the Department of Justice.
Could you see some kind of similar risks in our state?
So we are advocating for the Congress, together with others, to enact a new coverage formula that would trigger preclearance for other jurisdictions. But we, in particular, working with others, have promoted 2 different formulas for being covered. One based on history, as in the past. If you have a history of low participation and discriminatory measures being taken, then that specific jurisdiction, whether it's a state or a county, would be subject to preclearance on all of its electoral changes. But we have tried to add to that, and it's now been introduced in Congress, something called known practices coverage, which would say if you engage in kinds of changes that have proven through history to be used by those trying to suppress minority votes, then regardless of your history, you're going to have that change precleared. So, for example, if anybody in New Mexico wanted to do what Pasadena, Texas did, change from districts to at-large or partially at-large, under known practices coverage, that's a known practice. So it would have to be precleared, even if the jurisdiction didn't have a history of discrimination. So we're looking for coverage that would have an effect on every state where we see those who are trying to limit the growth of Latino political power. And unfortunately, that includes parts of New Mexico.
In our country, we have at least 27 Latinos who are eligible to vote. I would like to hear your opinion about if Latino political power is a myth or is a reality.
Well, that 27 million is a great, great potential for even more influence. But I think what we have seen is, despite this mythology about sleeping giant, that in elections, folks come out to vote when they think there's something to vote for. And that often means the presidential election. And I fully expect this year, as in the last 2 or more presidential elections, that the pundits on national television will say the Latino vote was decisive, that it played a role, if not a decisive role, in the outcome of the election. We will see that again. What we have to do is get that participation sustained in non-presidential elections. We always see a dip, every community does, in participation between presidential elections and then when we are electing in midterm, which is often equally critically important votes, like for the governor here in New Mexico. And we've got to get our participation levels up, even in those gubernatorial elections, as much as in the presidential elections. So I think there's lots of potential and lots of work to be done, but we certainly will be a decisive vote yet again this presidential election, if not the decisive vote, will be in our community. And we've got to make sure that the powers that be, those elected, remember that. Because what happens too often is we are identified on election day as having been a decisive part of the outcome, and then a little bit of time goes by and they forget that and start targeting the Latino community again. And we just got to deliver the message again and again. And if we can deliver it both in presidential elections and in gubernatorial elections and in local elections, that's when our influence and impact will be at its greatest.
Thanks so much, Thomas Sáenz, for coming to our Espejos de Aztlán show and for sharing all this knowledge about our state, knowledge about civil rights, not only for Latino people, but also for America.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today, Espejos de Aztlán. We had as our special guest Dr. Thomas Sáenz, MALDEF president, the Mexican American Legal Defense and the Educational Fund. Thank you so much. My name is Cristina Bachín.
Jazz.